Hello and welcome to LDS Women's Book Review Podcast, Season 7, Episode 2. We have a special guest with us here. I'm Shanda. I'm here with my friends.
Sheila.
And Mindy.
And would you like to introduce yourself, Mr. Guest?
Yes, this is Jeff Savage, and I'm here with my wife, Jennifer.
Hi.
We're so happy to have you both here. We love you guys both. You know that.
Thanks.
We're excited to get to talk to Jeff because it's been several years since we podcasted with him. And we've gone a little more high tech than the last time he was here, which hopefully is impressive considering how the last one ended.
I feel like I'm at a radio station.
I don't know where you want to. Do you want to just dive in? Do you want to just dive in, or do we want to talk about anything?
What do you want to talk about?
I can talk about whatever. I'm excited. We've got 3 books basically after 2 years of no books coming out. We've got my new Harper series, Case File 13, Zombie Kid, that came out in December, and my horror novel from Covenant, Dark Memories, that we're really excited about, just came out. It's in store shelves now. And then February 26th, the long-awaited 3rd book in the Far World series, Erky.
Cheering loudly!
So excited.
We're really.
I know my daughter is too. Very excited.
Yeah, but it's great success for you, which has been hard work for. You know, you've never stopped. You've just gone and gone and gone. So
come close to stopping a couple of times.
Aww, but good. Glad you didn't.
Yep, I am too.
But you're reaping the rewards.
Thank you.
All this, definitely.
Okay, so other than writing, what have you been up to lately?
Well, we are grandparents for the first time.
As of when?
Grayson is 4 months old?
5 months.
5 months old,
yeah. He's adorable.
Wait, you showed me pictures. I remember when he was just newborn, you showed me pictures when we saw each other.
Yeah, yep. He's big.
He's a big kid.
18 pounds, he's got a giant head.
So take that to grandpa.
He does. He pounds all the time. That's right, exactly.
Cute.
He talks all the time. He just does.
Oh, that's so sweet. Yeah. Can you believe it?
I know. So we've got a grandson. My oldest son got married
February.
Yep. So they're just coming up on their first anniversary. And other than that, just...
Do you have a missionary out?
No. He got back. We've got a 12-year-old and a 15-year-old that are involved in all kinds of different school things and all that. So
choir and musicals and yearbook and...
Yeah. Busy.
So instead of, you know, giving bottles and wiping bottoms and things like that, you just drive them everywhere.
Right. Right. We're looking forward to November when our 15-year-old turns 16. Then he can drive his dad.
That's
stuff.
Right.
Yeah, around.
We have kids the same ages. That's right.
Yeah.
My oldest in November, she'll be... 16.
Nice. Yes. We hope that's good.
On the other hand, I'm actually terrified to have her behind the wheel, to be honest.
Jake is such a responsible kid. I picked him up from a rehearsal one night, and there were some kids in the parking lot screwing around, you know, sitting on the hood of the car and, you know, being driven around. And Jake goes, I cannot believe kids do that. That is so irresponsible.
That kids do that. That's cute.
I would never do something like that. And he wasn't brown-nosing. I mean, he was really serious. He was offended by it.
Well, good. So you could trust him.
They were being so. Good. I think he'll be a good driver.
Well, I hope so too, for our sakes.
And you live where again?
That's right.
Just to hide out here for a little bit, about a year. Probably a good idea.
Yeah.
Anyway, so, okay, have you been able to read at all while you've been doing all this writing?
I have. I have to read. I also work a full-time job, which I'm actually taking a sabbatical on for the next 4 months to do school visits. But with that job, I work on the East Coast, so I fly just a ton. And I cannot get on a plane. I mean, if I accidentally get on a plane and realize that between my Kindle and
tragic.
What I've got in my bag, that there's something, I'm downloading like crazy. I got to get a book. I got to get a book.
I don't care what it is.
Exactly.
So I have to read as in, like, not required to, but have to because it's for your sanity?
Yeah. Gotcha. Yeah, absolutely. I grew up reading. That I just, you know, as a kid, I would cut school and go to the library, you know.
Cute. That explains so much about it.
That's why we get along so well.
Exactly,
that's
right.
We're all bookaholics. Yes.
Yep, that's it.
I understand that. Even if, there's something about a book, even if I never get around to reading it like this one, I carry it around everywhere.
Oh, yeah.
Just in case, because I do not want to even risk 5 minutes waiting in the parking lot for my daughter to come out of school without
having it. Oh, I go pick up my kids from dance or voice or what have you, and I always have it with me, even if it's...
Exactly.
1 minute. I'm like, I took him to tumbling the other day and I forgot it and I was like this.
What is something that has struck you in the last few months that you've read that has been just spectacular that you'd like to share?
I really loved The False Prince by Jennifer Nielsen.
I loved it too.
You know, it was funny. It was not exactly what I expected because I'd read The Goblin Wars and that was good and I really enjoyed that, but that was definitely written for a younger middle grade. So when I started reading The False Prince, I really think there are more books now, and it's kind of the way that I wrote Farworld, at least in my head, is that kind of tween to YA. And as soon as you start reading that, it's not the kind of more silly feel that you get with a lot of middle grade books.
Right.
There's a lot of depth both to the character and the plot and the motivations to the point where it really... could have been YA, but all the way through.
I always thought it was YA.
Yeah.
I kept thinking it was YA.
Yep. In fact, I think you could make a good argument that it is YA, but sometimes just from positioning, how the publisher wants to position a particular title.
Right.
But you could absolutely pick it up as a YA book and read it and not be disappointed.
Right.
I knew the first paragraph I was going to absolutely love it.
Yep.
And we were actually reading it
at the same time. Because we were going to review it together.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And I'm texting her and she's texting me and I'm just like, are you kidding me? I mean, just...
Well, I actually learned from this book.
I know.
Based on a review that was written by somebody on Goodreads that was a fellow author who, and I'm trying to remember, I think it was maybe Mary Gray, something like that. Anyway, she had said, and what did she call it? An undependable narrator.
Yeah, yep.
Exactly. And I said, unreliable, that's it. Unreliable narrator. And I said, that's what it's called.
Yeah.
I wondered because you think certain things. You don't realize how much you rely on a narrator to tell the absolute truth and reveal all.
That's right.
And it doesn't always happen that
and,
way.
And what I thought was so well done, particularly in that book too, though, is there's a bunch of things that at first you think, okay, well, wait, the narrator lied there. But if you actually go back and look...
I had to go back a few times.
Yeah,
and wait, okay. Oh, I didn't miss that.
Not a lie.
Well,
the classic example of that is Agatha Christie, who murdered Roger Ackroyd, because it's told from the point of view of the person who committed the murder. And everything he says in there is true, but you don't know until the very end that he was the one who...
Finn, I haven't read that one. But now, I mean, spoiler.
Agatha Christie!
So
I think we're safe.
Well, by this time, if you haven't read it, you're probably not going to, right?
Yeah. So I've got another fun one for you. And this is older readers, and this is a book that's going to take its time a little more. I describe this as, like, if you got a box of really, really rich, delicious, varied chocolates, okay? And it was something where you couldn't eat more than one at a time. This is not a book you're going to rush your way through, but as an author, it's something where I read, and the writing was just incredible. I'd read a chapter and say, even if you asked me to go back and try to rewrite that chapter, I couldn't do it. And it's called The Night Circus. And
I haven't heard of that.
I think I have seen it. I put that on my Goose and Reads list.
It is incredible.
Circus.
I mean,
who's
it won't
author?
Be like...
I'll tell you.
I don't know. We'll look it up and see who the author is. But someone on Goodreads said, I don't know whether to give this book 1 star or 1,000,000 stars. And that's exactly how I felt when I got done. It is not like... I can't compare it to any other book that I've read. It's just... Even if you go online and download the first chapter, and right away you'll get a feel for the writing style of this book. And if you don't like that writing style, then don't read it. But if you read it and just go, wow, that is so cool, the entire book is that way, where there's...
Hillary Knight,
okay. Yep, so that's a great one. It's kind of positioned as YA, but it doesn't jump you right into the action. It really kind of sucks you into the story, and you'll read a chapter or two and kind of need to take a break and then read another couple more chapters. But
you know what? I'm sorry,
good.
Jeff, that was not the author.
Okay.
Is it Knight or
Knight?
Knight. Okay.
Yeah, The Night Circus. It's a black and white cover of a kind of a circus tent there.
I did The Knight as in shining armor.
Gotcha.
See, I kind of felt that way about...
Oh, Aaron Morgenstern. Sorry,
that's
Aaron.
The one, yeah. We apologize, Aaron.
So I felt that way about I'm Not a Serial Killer.
Yeah.
I didn't know whether I hated the book or loved the book.
Yeah.
And of course, by the end of the series, of course, I loved the whole thing.
Exactly.
But it was like that, because I had never read a book quite like that before.
Right. Well, that character was so confusing. That's a very difficult... I was talking to Rob Wells about Dan writing that, and really the challenge with writing I Am Not a Serial Killer is taking a character like that main character and making him relatable and likable. And that's a trick to do. I think Dan pulled that off really well. But
brilliantly.
Yeah. Yeah.
I think so, too.
In fact, I put I Don't Want to Kill You as my best read of 2012.
Oh, yeah. I agree. It was great. I also read one more just fun. And I mean, it's not the writing doesn't blow me away. It's like the plot is fairly straightforward. But I just loved it. I read it with my kids afterwards. It's Ready Player One. It is basically, first of all, that part of it is just timing, but it's the story of a kind of dystopian type future where there is everyone goes into this online world, okay, and it's the Earth is really not something that most people like, and so they all go on to this world, and it's gotten to the point where this kid actually goes to school in this online world. The currency from this online game is more stable than the currencies in the countries, and the guy who invented this game dies, and he's going to leave his share of the company plus basically ownership of this game to someone who can find these three keys and go through these three gates. And the guy loved 70s and 80s trivia. So, I mean, the people who are the people who follow this and try to solve it, they're watching all the 70s TV shows, listening to 70s music, you know.
Yeah.
They've got their Atari and Commodore
Atari.
Video games.
Oh,
and,
right.
This is
what's
funny.
No, this sounds, it sounds like something you could write.
I very much, when I read that, I went, oh, God, I wish I, like,
darn,
like
where was I when
Prince,
this?
I read that and went, I don't think that exact way. I don't think I could write that book. Just
it's brilliant.
I would approach it differently. With The Night Circus, I could not replicate the style of writing. With Ready Player One, I just loved it and went, God, I wish I wrote that.
Yeah.
Just a lot of fun.
Well, weren't you, I saw a Facebook post from you last week or the week before that said, oh, I just had this great idea for this YA book.
I did.
Did you go home and write some on it?
Yeah, I've actually written about 10,000 words. It was something where I've got my middle grade stuff going. I've got the Far World series. I've got the Case File 13 series. And so I like to have something to play with when I'm not working on those. But right now I can't do middle grade. And so this idea, I kind of described it as a combination of Ender's Game, a little bit of Lord of the Flies, The Garden of Eden, 2001 A Space Odyssey.
Oh, my word.
It's this really kind of wild combination. And I ran it by my agent, and he gave me some feedback, and we went back and forth kind of playing with how to put it together. I wrote about 10,000 words and had a couple of beta readers read it, and I'm really excited.
Oh, wow, and that was just within the last 2 weeks?
Yeah.
How do you get on that beta reader list?
I would like to claim an in.
Absolutely. No, yeah, I'll definitely want some readers in this because it's challenging. One of the things I talk about in writing conferences and stuff is if you don't feel challenged at least a little bit by what you're writing, if you're not a little bit afraid that you can't pull it off, then you're not writing your very best stuff. I mean, I really think...
Oh, wow.
Think that, you know,
okay. Wow.
Yeah. Hey, can you just repeat that for me?
Exactly.
Seriously, I mean, I am terrified.
That's a good thing. If you're not, if you just go, yeah, I can do this in my sleep...
Oh,
it's
whatever.
Not going to be very good. I mean, look at Dan Wells' book that we were just talking about. You know that he had to be stressing, can I take a kid who basically is a serial killer and make him likable and relatable?
Or could be.
Right, yeah. I mean, maybe hasn't acted on it. Right, exactly.
Yeah.
You know, hasn't acted on it, but has all the other pieces there, which are all things that you shouldn't like. With this YA novel, it really is something where I went, okay, gal, can I do this? This is stepping out of my comfort
zone.
Cool. But, you know, that's Far World. I'd never written for kids. I'd never written fantasy. And suddenly, bam, it just came together. And I wrote the first five chapters trying to write one chapter to prove myself that I couldn't write it, you know.
And wow. Then, this is a story where you stayed up all night and all of a sudden,
exactly.
Like, 4 or 5 in the
yep.
morning,
you've
written.
Yep.
Yeah.
Yep. Well, even before I got into doing the review stuff, I found your blog somehow, I think, from James's.
Oh, yeah.
And so, yeah, you guest hosted, or we were at Middle Earth.
Yeah, that's right.
For our interview.
Exactly.
So
right.
It was fun. When I got an arc of Farworld. Yeah. It was so fun. It was fun.
It was a lot of fun.
Yeah.
I agree.
Go for it.
Well, just how you can just go, I think I'll just write about this now. I mean, really.
Yeah. Okay, so that's what you're currently working on, right?
I've got, I'm writing the fourth book in the Farworld series. That's really in the plotting stage right
and
now.
And is that slated for 2014?
That's January of 2014.
And what is it?
That's Airkeep.
Airkeep.
That's Firekeep. And then there'll be one more book called Shadowkeep. Yep.
Oh, that's right, because I remember you talking about Shadowkeep before.
Yeah.
That one's been in your mind.
That's the book that everyone's like, wait, okay, so you've got Waterland, Air, and Fire. What's the Shadow?
Exactly. What is that?
Yeah, exactly. So that'll be a lot of fun. I'm writing the third book, which is the last book that I currently have under contract. Hopefully this will be an open-ended series. In Case File 13, there's Zombie Kid. There is Making the Team, which is actually kind of a takeoff on Frankenstein. And then the third book that I'm actually writing right now, that I'm physically, you know, writing every day on, right now is called Double Trouble. And it's kind of combining doppelgangers and, if you remember the movie Gremlins, and it's the same feel that I've kind of gone for with the Case File 13. All of my, like, Kirkus reviews and stuff like that are like, it's scary enough that kids are going to find it scary, which is, you know, if kids are like, oh, that's kind of stupid, that doesn't work. But you've also got to have the humor along with it, you know.
And I think that's what, I mean, obviously, it's not my target audience book, but I loved it. But I can see what you're saying when he goes, when he's first at the house and he's following the cat, and yeah, that's a little tense, but then you add the humor in too to make it just perfect. So,
that's the goal, and I think Case File 13 is probably targeted a little younger. I don't know if I'd call it early middle grade, because a lot of times when you go early middle grade, you go for totally silly, you know, like
yeah. And I'm glad it's not that.
Yeah, that's that for me. I want a book that if I'm reading it to my kids, that I'm enjoying it while they're enjoying it, you know. So it's not as old as Farworld. It's not as old as The False Prince, but it's also not just the kind of straight. Like there's another book that's, you know, a cool book called Zombie Chasers. A little bit gory, but it's totally silly. It's really going for younger middle grade, and you know, it's all about the laughs and the gross out and everything like that. And I wanted this to be a little bit older feel. So.
Well, yeah, it worked.
I appreciate that.
It's really fun. I really liked it. I put that on one of my top of the year, too.
Yeah, it was. Yeah.
So, you know.
Yep, that's the podcast from last week.
Yeah.
Excellent.
Talking about our 20 best reads of 2012. So.
Nice.
We'll have to let Jennifer know about all of our gushing over her book. Was that her first book?
Nope.
No.
She did The Goblin Wars prior to that, which was younger
one.
Middle grade.
And was there two of those, or how? Or was there just one?
I think there's just one, yeah.
Okay.
I think she signed a multi... No, that may have... That, I think that was Alto with Scholastic. I don't know if it was part of a multi-book contract or not, but I know that was a standalone. And then she's also contracted to do part of the Infinity Ring series.
Yeah, she is.
Number 6.
Yeah, we knew that.
Yeah,
so. Which I'm already anxiously awaiting.
Yeah.
I know, it's number 6.
Oh,
I
yeah?
Know.
Yeah, number 6.
But it looks like it's going to be, I think False Prince is the first book of a trilogy. I think.
Yeah, it's a trilogy. The next one comes out this year.
March, yeah.
The King one. What is it called? The
Runaway King.
Runaway King.
Yeah. Looking forward to that.
Oh, me too.
And then did you also read that the something about the HBO people who are doing Game of Thrones are... working
yes,
on
yes, that's what she posted.
Oh, is that
I think
posted?
That's what she posted. I'm just like, oh my gosh, that is so cool.
Doing what? What's that?
Doing I don't know if they did it for HBO with Game of Thrones, so I don't know if that's what they're thinking, but it's the same group who has basically been contracted or something to create a script for The False Prince, and I could absolutely see them doing it the same way on HBO, because it's not dark and kind of gory like the Game of Thrones is, but it does have all those twists and turns that you could really see stretching it out into, you know, a miniseries or whatever. So.
That would be awesome.
Yeah. That'd be cool.
Someone approached you for a script for Case File 13?
Yeah. Well, we went back and forth. In fact, the timing was kind of funny, because when this came out, my agent immediately had a movie person, I don't know what they're called, but come to them and say, yeah, I want to represent this. And so they really liked it. And usually they'll do some other things, but they said, no, let's just send it out right now. And they kept talking about making it into an animated movie, which to me I didn't totally understand. Well, yeah. Then you see Frankenweenie and
Hotel
Transylvania and Paranorman and everything like that. So I think the timing may have been a little bit off there. We got a lot of good responses. I mean, it's really weird as an author to see responses back from, you know, Disney and Fox and MGM. And,
we really like this
and that, you know. So, but it didn't end up. We didn't end up doing a movie option on it yet. But it is an open-ended series. I mean, the goal that we've talked about with the publisher is making it along the lines of like a Warriors or a Goosebumps, where it's not three books or five books or six books. We did try to, in Zombie Kid, we tried to introduce in the first book some of the characters that expand as we go to the second book.
Very wise.
So, you know, you've got the three boys.
And then there's girls.
There's the three girls, yep, who are kind of their opposite, but, you know, also love monsters. There's
they're
the mysterious
fun.
Narrator.
Mm-hmm.
There's the bully. And then there's some other peripheral characters that we'll bring in. But, you know, all of them play a role in the second book. In fact, on the cover of the second book, you've got the boys and the girls.
And the girls.
And as they go through the chapter headings, you get all of them, plus the bully and everything, they all play a role. And
so
that's kind of the idea, is that it'll always stay from Nick's point of view, but different characters will play more prominent roles as we go through.
That's cool.
Yeah.
I can't wait to read it.
It's fun to actually see a book with Harper on it.
That's really cool.
Well, I have to tell you that this has been a lot of fun for us. I mean, I know Mindy's been with us for, what did you say, three years now?
Yeah.
And Sheila and I, you know, what is this?
Seven.
Seven.
Yeah. No, this is seven.
This is seven.
Yeah.
So this is our eighth year of doing this. And just watching Rob and you and James and all of these people who have, you know, who started not long when we first met you. You weren't far from where we kind of were, you know.
Exactly.
Just a few years out, you know, having your first books published, getting the word out about
them.
Well,
James came to our school a long time ago. So did Brandon. I mean, just...
And now here you are, national authors, published with Harper. And
it's nice to be part of that group.
I can't tell a lie.
Yes.
I don't know.
Rob was the first.
And then maybe it was Jeff, and then it was
Jeff,
Michelle.
And then it was Michelle.
Michelle Holmes.
Right.
Yep.
Yeah,
yep.
She's my writing buddy.
Excellent.
We're accountability partners with
Michelle's
each other.
Awesome.
Oh, that's fun.
Yep. Well, I'll tell you, I've got my agent, Michael Barrett, with Distel and Godrich, who's coming to the LDS Storymakers Conference.
Okay.
And he was talking about the fact that he was based out of New York. He lives in L.A. now, but he's actually got more authors living in Utah than he does anywhere else.
Really?
Yeah, he's got
my word.
James and me and Brody Ashton, Emily Wing Smith, Sarah Czar. I think there may be... Oh, Marion Jensen with his new middle grade series. Actually, Marion's with the same... Not only with the same imprint of Harper that I am, but he also has the same editor.
Oh, wow.
Oh, my
goodness.
It was
funny. My editor's Andrew Harwell, and... I learned that Marion had signed a contract with him, and I said, oh, yeah, he's a good friend of mine.
He'll
he's
be a
like,
perfect
wow, it's
middle
a small
grade
world.
Author.
And it's like, well, in Utah it is.
He'll be the perfect middle grade author. When is
this
stuff slated to come out?
For a
while?
It was originally going to be this fall. I think it got moved back to a spring release, so I'm thinking it's probably
next spring,
like March of 2014. Yep.
Oh, how exciting.
His
emails are just, they're funny.
He's hilarious.
He's very fun to follow on Twitter.
Oh, yeah. He is.
Between him and Krista Jensen and Rob.
Yep,
They keep me.
Oh, Rob's funny.
Yeah, I mean, this is all a fun group. These are all people that we've learned from knowing you and Rob and everybody, and just
and
seeing
really
all your successes.
Supportive.
So it's very,
very supportive.
Yeah, they are.
There's great community.
There isn't a writing community like this one.
I don't think there is, and you hear that a lot from, you know, national editors and agents and stuff. That I mean, in one way, writing is competitive, you know, because like anyone else, I don't know a writer that doesn't want to be successful and get more marketing and sell more books and everything like that. But, you know, the fact, I mean, Storymakers, I mean, just this year, I'm going to be at LTUE. I'm going to be at the Teen Authors Boot Camp. I'm going to be at Storymakers. I'm going to be at the writing and illustrating for young readers. And these are all opportunities where you can go and meet and brainstorm and work with pretty successful published authors at a fairly reasonable price. And I just don't think that kind of writing nurturing community is there are other great communities, but I honestly think that Utah does have the best community for nurturing new writers.
Yay, thank goodness.
Yeah.
We're here because
we're
in Utah.
Yeah. So do you think that it's part of the culture here about expanding on your talents? Do you think that's part of it, or do you think there's some other reason behind it being so tight-knit in Utah?
You know, I think there's a couple of different things. Part of it is that so many of us write in the same fields. And I'm not just going to say Mormon, because there's a lot of Utah authors that are not LDS.
Right, right.
But I do think that in the Utah community, we tend to write a little cleaner, less gory stuff. So a lot of us are pulled toward middle grade or young adult or some different things like that. The next thing is that a lot of these authors, you talked about this time frame of the last 7-8 years. Now, there are authors who were publishing before that. You know, Shannon Hale was,
right,
for example.
Mm-hmm.
Jessica DeGeorge, I think, started right about at that point. But there are, and then you've got guys like Dave Wolverton and, mm-hmm. and Tracy Hickman and that kind of thing. But I think that there is a whole, almost a generation of authors that have kind of all come up at about the same point and are all kind of encouraging each other and stuff. And one of the things that I tell people, ask about networking and things like that. And what you hear about networking is, okay, I introduce you to my agent or my editor or this kind of thing, who knows who. To an extent, that helps. But I firmly believe that a big part of it is watching other people within your peer group succeed,
mm-hmm.
and going, wait, if they can, suddenly you believe. Because when I wrote Cutting Edge, which was the first book that I wrote, that was 11 years ago, and I remember trying to find some other authors. There was nothing. There wasn't the blogs on the internet that you have now, nothing like that.
Oh, for sure.
I finally got hooked up with Chris Heimerdinger, who gave me some really good advice and really helped me out there, and so that was really positive. But there wasn't near as much of a community. Storymakers, there wasn't such
exist.
A thing,
mm-hmm.
Which has become, I think this year we're going to be somewhere between 400 and 500 attendees.
There
have
been for the last 3 years. They have to limit it to that.
Exactly. And this year, I think, with the conference center, it may even be allowed to grow bigger than that, you know, but that's a huge conference by any standard as far as a straight writing conference, you know. So I think a lot of it is just people encouraging people. When I joined my critique group, I don't know if everyone knows who my critique group is, but
I think we all know who.
Yeah, we do. You can tell the listeners if you want.
Okay, no, this it is not a critique group. It's the critique group.
Yeah. Everyone wants to be part of it.
Yes.
But let me see if I can name everyone.
Okay,
there's Annette Lyon, Michelle Holmes.
Yep.
You.
Uh huh.
Luann Staley, Heather Moore.
Sarah
and Rob.
Yep, Sarah Aiden and Rob Wells, exactly.
Mm.
And the thing is, when we started that critique group, when I first joined, I was the only one who had published a book. Cutting Edge just came out. And then I think shortly after that, Heather or Annette got published. But again, part of it is us encouraging each other and having a really great group of writers.
Right.
But also saying, hey, you can do this. You know, I mean, this writing is good enough to get published. You should get this out here. You know, and once you believe
that's
in yourself.
Teary.
Yeah.
That's really,
you know,
sweet.
It's not.
But it's not just that, though. I also know that it's a little, that your group can be pretty hardcore. It's not, you're not just about, you know, saying, oh, you can do it.
I love you.
You know what I mean?
Like, it's no, that's true.
Get the red pen.
Oh, yeah. We do. We have people
come. They can get pretty vicious sometimes.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean.
In a good way.
In a good way. That's exactly right. We do have people who will come to our critique group and go, how do you not walk away from this just in tears, you know? But the thing is, we really want that. One of the things that I've really learned is that if you don't get edits, if you give something to someone and they give it back to you,
oh, it's perfect.
Exactly.
Yeah.
It doesn't help you. It's really when someone comes back and goes, you know what, this worked and this worked, this did not work at all. I don't believe this. And we've got different people. I mean, you know, okay, this person, you know, is the person who's going to nail you on motivations. I just don't buy that this person would do that. Why would this happen? There's another person that's like, okay, wait, you've got your character reaching behind his head, grabbing this. I'm trying to figure out, you know, and I mean, you'll see it.
How does that work? Cute.
Yeah.
Logistics.
Exactly.
Right?
Logistics. You've got people who are really good at, you know, because we've got both guys and women there, you know, we'll come back and go, I'm sorry, you're perfect guy. Maybe he does all this stuff, but that's not a guy, the way a guy responds. It's just not, you know.
And then they'll come back to me. Different genres, too.
Yeah, it comes from quite a variety.
And
that's been a lot of critique groups are they're all fantasy writers or they're all YA or stuff. And we've got we've got women's fiction, we've got romance, we've got middle
Regency
grade,
romance,
we've got YA,
too.
Regency romance, exactly.
Historical.
You know, so,
Fairy tale,
mysteries, yep.
Slash dystopian-ish.
Slash dystopian-ish.
We don't really know what to call variant without giving things away. So, you know.
Speculative.
That's a good speculative.
Yes.
Kind of all around. I personally think going and having my stuff ripped apart in your critique group sounds like heaven.
Oh, yeah.
I would happily cry. I'd be crying for all sorts of reasons coming back from a place like that. But
How often do you meet?
It's like the holy grail of critique.
Thank you. It is. I really
is
like it.
Is it a monthly thing?
We meet weekly. We don't always manage to do it, but we actually just got some shirts that we're going to wear to Storymakers.
Oh, fun.
This year was the year.
Did you make another video?
The butter shirt. Rob's ornaments, did they turn out? The butter churn?
Rob did his butter churn ornaments.
Oh,
yeah.
Awesome.
They're called the Women and Men of Wednesday Night. And so we try to meet. It's usually either Wednesday or Thursday. We've had people off and on. I mean, lately Rob struggled a little bit to make it down there just with some of the things that he's going through. And, you know, if I'm on the road a lot traveling. But the thing is that unless it's a holiday, every week there is an email that goes out that says, okay, you know, here's the schedule. Wednesday, Thursday, yes or no, who can do it? And if we don't get at least three people, then we won't.
Mm.
But some of it is the hardcore critiquing that we're all pretty good at. I mean, I remember the first time I went to the critique group, and these people were reading their stuff for, you know, 6 to 10 minutes, and everyone's scribbling and making all these notes and everything as it's being read, and I'm just like, I can't do this, you know? What the heck, you know? But you get to the point where pretty quickly you can listen to the story, look ahead, get a feel, say, okay, this, you know, and you make your notes, and there are different people. When Annette gets done, it looks like your page has just been bloodied, you know? I mean, someone stabbed it everywhere. Their joke about me is that I'm like, okay, so I've got two things here, you know? They tend to be fairly bigger things, you know? But it's really helped us put that together. But there's also the part where we might sit for an hour just talking about latest publishing issues that we've dealt with, what's going on, what this person heard back. We're pretty good. I mean, there's things that we probably couldn't share in public, but where we can talk about, you know, okay, this is what's happening with this. Here's, you know, the feedback my editor gave me. You know, it really helps us to be able to know, okay, these are the kind of advances that people are getting. Here's what they're having agents say. Here's what they're hearing. And when you have seven people that are really involved in the writing community, there's a lot of stuff. Oh, did you see this blog where this person was talking about looking for this? Or, you know, this person said that.
So it's a good way to stay in the know in regards to your
it really
marketing
is.
And your employment.
Yeah, your career.
And so that's why, even though sometimes it seems like once a week is a big commitment, and, you know, we'll get there at 7. We may not get home until 11:30. But I never fail to come home from a critique group unmotivated to go back and write something because it really keeps your focus on what you're trying to accomplish.
Well, considering how much this is your livelihood, once a week actually doesn't seem too
That's
bad.
That's very true.
Yeah.
And everyone in that group, you know, I said that I was the first one to publish a book. I think we totaled it up the other day.
I was wondering about the total.
Oh, yeah, please. I'd love a total.
I think it's probably about 40 or more books that we've published.
That's
multiple awards.
It
could be. We might be over 50 or 60 now, but it's a lot. And with national publishers, LDS publishers, some self-publishing, just a whole variety of different things that
we've Heather just put something out, The Heart of the Ocean.
Yes.
She did that on her own.
Exactly.
And it's good.
That was actually... It was funny when that was one of the very, I think it was the second book that she read when I joined the group.
Yeah, I was going to say, she said it was pretty early on that she gave this to the critique
and
group
made a lot
and
of
came
fact.
Back to it.
Yeah,
uh-huh.
Back then she'd be reading it and we'd come back and say, okay, now, so it seems like you might be kind of hinting in this chapter that this is going to occur. And she's like, it might. I'm not sure.
No.
I know. That's a good idea. That's right.
That's
yeah.
So I have two questions for you. The first one is, you know, who has had the most impact on you in your personal life and in the writing world on your work and your success?
Uh-huh.
You know, who could you attribute that to the most? And I know one of them sitting right there.
Yep, absolutely.
But the other is, okay, answer that one.
Answer that one, Marty.
Answer that one, and I'll try to remember what my other question was.
Well, I mean, most people who know Jennifer and I know that, I mean, if I ever end up getting a Whitney Award or some award, and I think I've like lost six of those now, you know, and having seen The False Prince, I'm pretty sure I'm going to lose seven. But if I ever went up to accept an award, I would have to take Jennifer up with me because we really are a team. In fact, people ask me, I'll be talking about a story, and it's like, well, we wanted to do this, and then we decided, and they're like, did you co-write this with someone? You know, are you talking about you and your agent or editor? And it's like, no, it's just Jen and I. I mean, if we're doing school visits, as we're writing, as we're brainstorming, and a lot of times, you know, when I'm doing a series, like you and I were talking about a little bit earlier, you are a little bit blinded. You're not entirely sure. If it's something you've written a lot, you know if you've got it down or not. But when you're trying something brand new, you don't know if it's working. And so I can go back to Jennifer and say, be totally honest with me, is this working or not? And if it's not, she'll tell me. And if it is, you know, she'll tell me.
And that's a real test of your marriage, if you can be that completely honest.
Not all couples can.
Right. My most famous one was he started writing something that...
That didn't get finished.
No. But he started writing it in a really folksy kind of narrative voice. You know, well, friends and neighbors, you know.
I don't think it was exactly like
that. But that was the kind of film.
You get the gist.
And I came back and I said, you're trying too hard. And that phrase.
That's funny.
We don't
and
see
the
that
face.
Exactly.
Yeah, we don't see that anymore.
That phrase has been banished. Really?
Sure,
yeah.
No, but even then, though, I mean, she was right, and you know, we work really well and get along that way. So.
We do.
That's awesome.
I mean, we'll be driving in the car, and he'll say, okay, so this character, you know, and he'll go off. And I mean, we sit at lunch. I'm his sounding board.
Me too.
We just go back and forth, and I say, well, what about this?
Yeah.
I mean, the best example is his first Chandra Covington mystery.
Oh, really?
Yeah.
Which is actually where I met you. Talking about your first Chandra Covington mystery at the Covenant Mystery Dinner.
Oh, that's
that
right.
One there.
Oh, wow. Fun.
Yeah. And I remember because, you know.
Are you going back to her? Well, obviously you're
not
going to have time.
The plan was to write four books. By the third book, it's kind of like the series, the sales were dying out a little bit. So it would probably be self-publishing. I do know where I want to wrap it up, and there's some things that are left hanging. Nothing huge. Not like my second book where I got, like, you know, hate mail.
Yeah.
It wasn't just hate mail. It was a campaign.
It was a campaign.
She and Hillary were the culprits. I was waiting patiently.
Well, we'll see. I'm not quite that bad in my third Far World book, but in Airkeep there is definitely an unexpected twist that will be interesting.
Thanks for the warning.
But I have gotten several beta readers back who have come back and said, oh my gosh, that was, you know, incredible.
That was awesome.
Yeah,
good.
So
as a reader, though, I do love surprises,
yeah,
for sure.
As long as they're in line, you know what I mean? As long as they're not... as long as they're appropriate surprises.
Exactly.
You know?
If you haven't built up to it in some
credible.
Way. Yeah.
Credible. That's the
absolutely.
Word I was searching
for. Yep. If it just comes out of the blue and you're like, okay, you know.
Okay,
where,
Chandra's an alien.
Yeah.
That wouldn't be credible.
Well, I mean,
she's the original zombie kid.
See, and that's where you look back at stuff like we were talking about, I'm not a serial killer, you know. There's a big twist halfway through I'm Not a Serial Killer.
Right, a huge one that I didn't
genre
and
big
I,
twist.
I
yeah?
called Sean and I said, am I reading this right? am I sure? Did I miss something?
I ended up loving it. Like, at first I was kind of like, what? I felt
yeah.
a little misled. But then after that, I was totally sold.
Yep,
and
it worked
same.
From there on out.
Mm-hmm.
Yep, that's right. But it would have been easy to do that same story in lesser hands and say that just didn't work at all, you know, mm-hmm. because it is such a big twist. But
so do you have a twist kind of like that in Airkeep then?
Or I won't give to it. It's not a twist like that, but I will say that when I was reading it to my kids, there were certain assumptions, and that's when I do beta readers, the big reason that I want that is I want to know what you're thinking. And they would say certain things, not to give it away again, but they would say, okay, well, I know that this happens or this isn't going to happen or whatever, and I'm just kind of smiling. And when we got to just about the end, you know, there's a little epilogue afterwards, but when we got to the last chapter and finished it, both of my boys, who are 12 and 15, they're just, like, silent.
Oh, my
word. I mean,
not
saying a word. And finally, after, like, 2 minutes of silence, Jacob goes, when's the next book?
Well, son, I'm writing it right now. You can kind of have an in.
Exactly. That's right.
So there's one thing fun. I've learned about Mindy.
Yep.
And that is, and you probably learned that just from our little podcasting session here, is that she's an impatient reader. She's one of those that likes to say, but what's going to happen? Or does what happens here? And what's going on with her father? And blah, blah, blah. And I finally texted her the other day and said, you're like my kids when I tell them, just watch the show.
I laughed my head off because I did the same thing with my kids. And I'm like, well, that's really good.
I know. I just was laughing.
I'm very impatient.
I was laying in bed with Randy trying to read it. Like, he was reading me a story and he kept texting. And I said, you're like one of my kids. And I say, just watch the show.
I know. But it's so true because that's me exactly.
So it's going to be interesting to see her reaction after she reads Airkeep.
I will.
I'm excited.
You know, I told you the thing about being a little bit scared. So I told Lisa, in fact, I don't even think that Chris knew, Lisa Mangum. I told Lisa Mangum what I was going to do. And she's like, okay, well, I mean, I have to see how you do it because it's something where I'm not entirely sure that I could do it. And then when she read it, she's like, okay. No, she said, good, you pulled this off really well. This works. This fits the middle book in a series. It's exactly where you should be. And we were having lunch, kind of a marketing lunch, with me and Lisa and Heidi, who's the product manager, and Chris Schobinger. And Chris hadn't finished reading it yet. And so I said something. Again, do not give anything away. And Chris, this expression, he looks at me, wait, you what? And Lisa just
I'm
it's
scared.
Okay, it's fine.
I'm scared.
It's totally
I'm
good.
Scared. I'm scared.
I trust Lisa, though, because she's a very particular editor. She's she knows how she wants things to be and how things need to be to be their best.
And so. She really, again, you know, we were talking earlier about needing editors and the role that they play. In Airkeep, I actually had two editors. So when I first turned the book in, Lisa was the one that read it. And she came back with a big list of questions. I mean, almost to the point that it's kind of depressing as an author where you're just like, wow, I mean, can I deal with all this? But they were all good questions, and as you checked one off and fixed that and went through, you went, okay, this story is getting more solid. So great. I made those changes, and then we set it off. Actually, Annette Lyon was contracted to be the primary editor who went through page by page.
Awesome.
Well, while she was making those edits, Lisa came back and reread my changes. So now I had Lisa's feedback and Annette's feedback, and I could go through and work with those. And by the time I got done, it was a much more solid story. And that's really the key from a good editor is that they come back and say, boy, you nailed this. This is just awesome. I love this. But this, to me, I'm not buying this. And, you know, what? Why do we, you know, did you do this because as an author you needed to have it happen, or do you have really sound reasons behind it?
So when you've got, so there'll be the five, possibly the five. So
five books,
do you give them, like, a heads up and, like, oh, I'm thinking this will happen in five? Or so they kind of know where you're going with the story.
Sometimes. Like, in Case Files, really what we talked about was we're going to grow the world. We want the boy and the girls. What kind of point of view do we want to stick with? And who's kind of our target reader? Okay, we're going younger middle grade, but like Finding Nemo, where kids and adults can watch it and enjoy it. That kind of a feel to it. That's what we're doing there. Because each book is kind of a standalone, we didn't have to necessarily, it's like, okay, the first book is going to be zombie. The second book is kind of a Frankenstein type takeoff. The third book, I told them, here's kind of what I'm thinking. They came back and asked some questions. One of the things that we had decided we wanted to do in Case File 13, that it was nice, again, that reviewers talked about, is that there's some things you can learn. Like in the first one, even though we're talking about zombies, I did real voodoo research, and mm-hmm, we do talk mm-hmm. about, you know, what a gri-gri is, what a bokor
right.
is, and I use those actual words and stuff, and so it's kind of interesting. When I went into making the team, which comes out in September, what we were actually doing is, you know, we did research on when Mary Shelley wrote Frankenstein, what was it based on? Who were the scientists at that time?
Wow.
Why did they believe that electricity was this kind of magic that could bring people back to life? Because they did, you know, that at the time they believed that what made your muscles move was probably hydraulics from your blood. And it wasn't until they were dissecting a frog and got a little static electricity and touched the dead frog's muscle with the scalpel, right, and there was a little spark and it made the frog's leg move, and suddenly they went, oh my gosh, you know,
electricity.
So if we could put electricity into a dead body, and now they're trying to, you know, to pull a soul from one just all this weird stuff. So those were all things that we went through in Far World. Because it is a 5-book, it's like a trilogy, I don't know what you'd call a 5-book trilogy, but that's what
right.
it is, like Fablehaven was, and they've done several series
yeah,
like
Fablehaven
that
had 5.
They kind of wanted to know what the story arc was, you know, so what's going to happen in book 1? Where do we go in 2, 3, 4? You know,
the overarching.
So, yeah, yeah, kind of
the big story arc.
Exactly.
Right. Okay.
What happens individually? Like I said, the big, if you want to call it twist or surprise or whatever that happens in book 3. I knew that was going to happen about halfway through book 2. My publisher didn't really know it until I gave them the manuscript and said,
mm-hmm.
"Here's what
this
I'm doing."
This is what I'm thinking. Yeah.
I do know, and my publisher knows how book 4 will end. There's a moment in book 4 which should be a pretty jaw-dropping moment that really is, again, kind of the last moment there where you're like, wow. But when you look back, and we talked about credibility, what happens at the end of book 4, you'll be able to look all the way back to book 1 and say, oh, yeah, there was that clue. I missed it because it was set up this way, but
oh,
this
wow.
was set up to do that. And so that's the thing is if I know in advance, like I did with them, that it's a 5-book series, then there's things that I can do. If you take a look, for example, at certain books, like Variant is a good example, okay? So when Rob wrote that first book, or Maze Runner for that example,
mm-hmm.
they both knew where the stories could go, but they were both sold potentially as standalone with series potential. Then the publishers came
okay.
back and said, I want that. And one of the things Rob talked about, and I don't know if he's been on a recent podcast, but at the end of Variant, mm-hmm. He had a main character really seriously injured. And in looking back, he said, I wish I hadn't made that character that injured, because it made it difficult
To help her
yeah. in the next story.
Yeah.
Exactly. And so in this case, because I knew it was 5 books, I could plan
yeah.
exactly. And it also, you know, I had some people who read Landkeep and said, well, that seems like the big climax. I mean, you know, here we've got, you know, the main character up with his gauntlet, and he can save the world, and he's got to go this direction and stuff. Where do you go? How does the next story get bigger? But it will, because I knew where the arc was going,
mm-hmm.
you know, where it was going. So you're not in danger of writing a book where book 3 or book 4 or book 5 feels like a drop-off, you
mm-hmm.
know. And that's one of my things that I try to avoid. I've had, again, questions. People say, well, so when you finish the Far World series, will you do another series with Shadow Mountain? Well, definitely. I'd love to. Well, will it be another series in Far World? I don't want it to be.
Right.
I don't want to do... I love Ender's Game, but I honestly don't want to read any more Ender's Game's books. There's been
right.
so many books in that world.
Right.
I'd rather find something new, and that's the same way I feel with Shadow Mountain. I'd rather come up with a whole new, exciting world that readers can follow.
And you may have. With your idea
possible.
From 2 weeks ago.
Entirely possible.
It's probably there.
Well, one of my questions was going to be, when everything that you have is done, yeah. what's next?
You can find the rest of our interview with Jeff Savage in Season 7, Episode 2, Part 2.